This is going to sound harsh, but I'm pretty sure it's true. Economically, we're on our own for like a month. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 14th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, it used to be, and granted, this was a while ago, but it used to be that August was a news dead spot. But times, as we know, change. So we have got a lot to pack into the next 5 minutes and change on this radio program. Here to help us do that, Arneela Richardson. She's a principal at Edward Jones. Anna Swanson is with the New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai. Hey, Kai.
So, Neela, let me start with you with the observation that Congress is out of town till the 8th of September, I believe, both houses. No deal has been passed. Aid has been stopped at the end of July. Am I right that we're on our own?
Some families are very much on their own. That government support was a critical bridge during a terrible time for many Americans facing either eviction or job loss. In fact, the Federal Reserve has put out numbers that 40% of low-income paying jobs were lost as a result of the pandemic. That stimulus was critical. And I will say that the markets have been rallying on federal support as well. The difference between the markets and a household is the markets can wait till September. Many of these vulnerable households can't.
Right, exactly. So, Anna, you know, there is the case to be made. And Heather Long in the Post, one of our Friday colleagues here, a competitor of yours, apologies, at the Times, she pointed out, you know, for the upper income spectrum in this country, the recession's over already, basically. But as Neela pointed out, it's not for those at the lower ends.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a great article. I don't mind giving Heather props for that. I mean, recessions always hit the poorest people the hardest, but this one is truly extreme. You're seeing the stock market and home values at records, and vacation homes are in demand, and a lot of college-educated workers have transitioned to working at home just fine. Meanwhile, you know, those in the service sector have had their jobs disappear. They're being forced to choose between food and rent and their car payment. You know, and of course, all of that hits people of color disproportionately, who have, you know, historically lower earnings and less wealth. And we're definitely going to see a really sharp increase in inequality here, and it will be even worse if the government doesn't act. And the way the government has responded has definitely worsened that as well. The fact that Congress is not providing those benefits to people who need them most. The Fed has stepped up, but that mainly pumps money into the financial system and the bond market, and that helps people more at the top than at the bottom.
Well, so Neela, riff on that for a little bit, because you alluded to it. The stock market has, opinion coming here, spoiler alert, has become disconnected from what's actually going on. Discuss.
Oh, I'm so excited you let me rap and riff in the same time. This is incredible. You know, first of all, to piggyback on what Anna was saying, you know, higher income consumers, they spend based on how they feel. That's why consumer confidence indicators are so important. But lower income individuals, they spend on what they have. That's why income and stimulus is so important, because they have a higher tendency to spend out of income, whereas higher income people typically save or invest. So where's the takeaway for the markets? The markets are forward looking. They look at the stimulus. They look at the Federal Reserve reach into the credit markets that are going to keep interest rates low for a very long time. And they see that the greatest alternative is stocks, and not all stocks, bear you mind, that the highest performers have been the leaders going into the pandemic. Those five mega tech firms that seem to be impervious to the pandemic, which only amplifies the disconnect between the stock market leaders, the rest of the stock market, and Main Street.
Right, right. Anna, a brief detour to trade here, if I might. The president went to New York today. He did a gaggle, I think, when he got there. There were some questions about China trade talks. They were supposed to be tomorrow. They have since been postponed. The president said this today to reporters. He said, "We're doing very well on our trade deal, but I feel differently about China than I've ever felt." Lots in there. Are we doing well on our trade deal with China?
Well, you know, it does seem to be kind of a surprising source of stability in what is otherwise a really quickly deteriorating relationship. So, you know, the trade deal in itself could be in some trouble because China hasn't necessarily been keeping up with some of its purchasing commitments. It promised to buy $200 billion of additional goods before the end of next year, which is a huge number. And it's not making, it's only about 50% of the way towards where it should be to that target, in part because of the pandemic. So, you know, there could be some trouble yet in store for the trade deal, but I think the point is right now it looks more stable compared with every other area of the U.S.-China relationship, which is basically just in free fall, you know, from diplomacy to geopolitics to technology.
It's kind of amazing that trade is a stable point in that relationship, man. Right. Okay, so Neela, one more thing, and I want to look forward a little bit. Quarter two and quarter three gross domestic product, right? Two was terrible, as we know. Quarter three is expected to be a big bounce back from a really low base. But then what happens, right? Put on your professional economist hat here and predict sort of the out months for me.
Quarter three, big bounce back and recovery, but then Q4 is still a question mark. In fact, what you might see given the injury and damage in the labor market that we're still working through is a very prolonged and protracted recovery. And this, again, going back to your stock market dissonance question, this is where markets may not fully reflect the future, that there is a recovery to come, but it's probably longer than anyone is expecting right now and longer than we'd all like to see it.
Neela Richardson at Edward Jones and Anna Swanson at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Have a nice weekend if you can out there. On Wall Street today, well, they were a little undecided, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the good people at the Commerce Department came this item today. Retail sales for the month of July up 1.2% from June. Gains pretty much across the board, though remember, as Neela alluded to, we are digging out of a real big early pandemic hole. She didn't allude to it. She actually said it. But we noticed something in the retail sales numbers this morning. Overall, retail sales are actually almost 3% higher than July of last year in the before times. What? Marketplace's Marielle Segarra explains what's going on.
Taylor Fenske says if you told him in March that he was about to spend 6 months basically unable to leave his house, go to restaurants, or travel, he would have expected to save a lot of money. He would have been wrong.
Mostly I'm spending money on wood.
Fenske, who works in public relations and lives in New Jersey, has spent about $1,500 building a desk, TV tables, a plant stand, a nightstand, and a corner table.
You know, I wake up on Saturday just thinking, like, what the hell am I going to do to fill my time today? So I just walk around until I see something that needs to be fixed.
This is exactly what today's retail numbers show us. People are still shopping, just for different things. Sales at home and garden stores are up by almost 15% compared to last year. And they're up almost 18% at stores that sell musical instruments, books, and sporting goods. Doug Hermanson is an economist at Kantar. He has not had time to pick up any new hobbies.
As an economist, obviously, work starts to ramp up when these things occur.
But he has been biking more, so he bought some exercise shirts, and he's in the market for a new ride.
You're not spending money in other places, and so you're kind of focusing on that one area that you are able to be passionate about. And yeah, that shows up in these numbers.
Another reason retail sales are actually higher than they were a year ago, online sales have also jumped by almost 25%. The big question now is, can this last without another relief package from Congress? Because without those additional unemployment benefits, people will have less money to spend on retail therapy. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Given everything that is going on in this world right now, it can be tough to raise awareness about anything using social media. But for at least a couple hours yesterday, the hashtag Black Women's Equal Pay Day was one of Twitter's top trends. It's about the gap between what black women make and what white men make. The average black woman earns just about 62 cents for every dollar the average white man makes. And so, black women had to work until yesterday, August the 13th, 2020, almost 8 additional months, to take home as much as white men did by the end of 2019.
As a society, right, we're quite primed and aware of the gender wage gap issues.
Michelle Holder is an assistant professor of economics at John Jay College at the City University of New York.
You hear it a lot of different places. You know, it's something that women who are workers talk about a lot. But this wage gap issue gets worse for women of color.
Women as a whole make around 82 cents on the dollar compared to white men, which puts that overall equal pay day back on March 31st. The wage gap for black women, remember, is 62 cents. On the dollar.
I call it the double gap, meaning that black women not only face the gender wage gap, but black women also face a racial wage gap.
There are a couple of reasons why.
Simply put, white men have, on average, higher educational attainment levels than black women. That plays a role in employability, and that plays a role in wages.
Also,
occupations that employ the most women in the U.S. tend to be lower paying than occupations where men predominate. That's just kind of the way it is.
And then?
And then there's a third element, which really boils down to discrimination and bias.
So what can we do? How do we use this moment to make an economy that works for everyone? We're taking a stab at that question in a special hour for Marketplace, The Economy Reset.
Solving the race gap is not about getting a college degree. It's not about buying a house. It's actually about changing an institution.
I had a white male colleague and a white female colleague, and I noticed that I was being paid $5,000 to $10,000 less.
Through many black neighborhoods, you'll find plenty of petty lenders and check cashes, but unfortunately, not very many banks.
It really does have to be a true conversation about power.
You can hear our special on local public radio stations or online. It lives at marketplace.org on The Economy What Now page. Coming up,
we need now to start looking elsewhere for where we solve our problems.
I mean, fair enough, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 34 points this Friday, a tenth percent, 27,931. The NASDAQ down 23, about two-tenths percent, 11,019. The S&P 500 basically flat, 33.72. For the week, the Dow up 1.8%. Today, the NASDAQ picked up a 10%. The S&P 500 rose 0.6%. If you are planning on hitting the road this weekend, a gallon of regular gas is going to run you just shy of $2.18 on average. That's according to AAA, basically what it cost a week ago, a couple of cents less than a month ago. But compared to the before times a year ago, the price of a gallon of gas has fallen more than 17%. The price of bonds rose today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury stayed at 0.71%, though. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sometimes you come upon an economic story and you're like, oh, hey, that's good. And then you dig in a little bit and you're like, oh, no, wait, what? Thus, it is with this next item, a new report from S&P Global Market Intelligence, noting that banks have been able to pay down some of their debt during the pandemic. Marketplace Justin Ho is on Explainers today.
Back in March, when the pandemic started freaking everyone out, companies went to their banks and drew on their existing lines of credit. Karen Petru with Federal Financial Analytics says companies were hoarding cash.
Companies drew every nickel of cash they could get out of their banks just in case.
That was during the first quarter. In the second, some companies started receiving government aid, Paycheck Protection Program loans. Nate Tobik at Complete Bank Data says by then, non-PPP loans started to seem unnecessary for a lot of companies.
They didn't need the credit lines they drew, and so they paid it down.
It's not necessarily a good sign for economic growth. In normal times, companies use bank loans to expand, maybe launch a new project or build a new office. But now, Tobik says,
a lot of commercial projects are just frozen because no one really knows what's going to happen with retail demand, hotels, travel.
Instead, companies are paying their loans back and focusing on their existing businesses. Kent Belasco runs the commercial banking program at Marquette University. Thinking is, he says,
if my business is pretty much closed, there's not a whole lot I can do except to make sure that I can get my employees back and that I have a business in the future.
He says the drop-off in loans is also an indicator of how banks are feeling about the future. Rather than issuing new loans, he says banks have been bulking up their reserves in case their existing loans go bad.
They're looking ahead and they're a little bit concerned because I think they are anticipating losses that are going to come out of this.
Belasco says bigger banks have enough capital on hand to absorb losses, but smaller banks could have trouble. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This pandemic is a crisis across the board. Health, of course. Economic, also of course. Education, same. And now it's becoming clear, mental health too. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control shows Americans are increasingly showing signs of anxiety and depression, turning to substance abuse and contemplating suicide more as well. One group that has been especially hard hit, which makes total sense when you think about it, essential workers. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Ashley Hines works not one, but two essential jobs in Fort Worth, Texas. She's a package handler for a shipping company and does on-site tech support for an aerospace firm. But last Monday, she just needed a break.
It was just one of those days. I was able to tell my boss, you know, hey, I want to take a mental health day.
She worries about her own health. As a Black woman with diabetes, she's particularly at risk. And because she works outside the home, she doesn't want to endanger her friends or family, so she's usually alone.
It's depression, but it's like a monkey on my back. Like I have nowhere to go, nobody to go see, and that's the hard part.
According to the CDC report, more than half of essential workers have experienced mental health issues in recent months. That's 25% more than the general population. More than a fifth had contemplated suicide. Many low-wage service jobs have become less secure. Kiara Iverson has seen her hours cut at a big box store outside Milwaukee.
It is a bit scary because, you know, my relatives are older. We don't have enough money in our pockets to deal with all that.
Jobs in healthcare, while always stressful, have become even more traumatic during the pandemic, says Dr. James Rashal, a psychiatrist with Atrium Health in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Especially early on in this disease process, there was very little we could do. And so it was very disempowering for a lot of healthcare workers that typically have some solution or some cure at their fingertips. Sometimes it was colleagues they were seeing that were getting sick.
Ironically, he says, getting help for mental health issues often hasn't been accepted or prioritized in the field. And many essential service workers have limited resources for help. Sarah Norton heads a Twin Cities nonprofit that offers counseling services to restaurant workers.
The industry itself was lacking a safety net prior to this.
She says she's seen a 75% increase in calls to their crisis hotline since the pandemic began. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Learn something new every day in this job, as I have said before. And here is today's example. Beijing, it turns out, controls about 70% of the global market in batteries for electric cars, which seems significant. And they've pretty much got a stranglehold on the rare earth elements that go into every single unit that they ship. You roll those two things together, that is an energy security issue. So in the UK, there's a campaign to move away from battery power toward hydrogen, in which, as it happens, the Brits have something of an edge. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The sound of this hydrogen-fueled car is music to the ears of former Cabinet Minister Ian Duncan Smith. For starters, it doesn't emit any carbon, and also it's not battery-driven.
The rush to electric power was, I thought, not particularly well thought through, because the biggest producer of batteries has become China.
And he says increasing the UK's economic dependence on a communist dictatorship is madness.
We need now to start looking elsewhere for where we solve our problems and where we get our goods and services.
He says we can find the alternative source of energy for transportation much closer to home.
4-4-4-2.
This hydrogen-powered bus, recently trialled in central London, was built by the Wrights Group in Northern Ireland. The firm's CEO, Bhuta Atwal, says the technology is in many ways superior to battery power. A tank full of hydrogen will take a vehicle much further.
And also it's easier to refuel and recharge than a battery. A battery would normally take 4 hours to recharge, where hydrogen is maximum 10 minutes to refuel, similar to a diesel operation.
His company built the world's first hydrogen double-decker bus. He sold 35 of them in the UK and is stirring interest abroad.
We are getting inquiries from India, Australia, America and Asia as well.
Britain seems to have a global lead in hydrogen technology. The world's top producer of electrolyzers, the devices that extract hydrogen from water, is based in Britain. And there's a raft of hydrogen startups here. At a workshop in the middle of Wales, Hugo Spowers and his team at River Simple are making a snazzy little two-seater hydrogen car, which he insists will be competitive.
The cars we're planning to bring to market in 2023 will be cost equivalent with a combustion engine car and cheaper than a battery electric car.
He has nothing against battery cars, he says. They're fine for relatively short journeys.
A battery electric car for 100-mile range makes absolute sense, and they're really, really good and we need them.
Elon Musk doesn't feel the same about your technology. He says it's mind-bogglingly stupid.
He sells battery electric cars, so what do you expect him to say?
But hydrogen cars do face a headwind here. There are only 18 hydrogen refuelling outlets compared with 8,000 gas stations and 32,000 battery charging points. The momentum is with electric. The advantage is with China. This was the launch in Guangzhou back in April of the XPeng P7 Coupe. It's a sleek new addition to the 2.5 million battery-powered cars already plying China's roads. The technology is unstoppable, says Professor David Bailey of the Birmingham Business School. And so, he believes, is China's domination of it.
I think the balance of power in the auto industry will very much shift towards China. The Chinese government really have decided that they can't compete in the internal combustion engine, and so they're going electric for that reason. So all roads lead to China, ultimately.
China achieved its lead by massively subsidising electric vehicles. Whether the UK is prepared or even able to do the same for hydrogen seems doubtful. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I give up. I give up, I give up, I give up. Pumpkin spice has won. It was inevitable, I suppose, but this news from Dunkin' Donuts has broken me. Dunkin' is coming out with its annual fall menu, including, of course, pumpkin spice lattes, next Wednesday, as in next Wednesday, as in still August. August! Starbucks is targeting the 25th. Again, of August, says Dunkin's marketing chief, while there is so much uncertainty heading into the fall, one thing our fans can count on is the return of pumpkin at Dunkin'. All y'all have at it. I'm out. Can't fight it anymore. Come on, you guys, it's August. Pumpkins probably aren't even grown yet. All right, we are going, but not without this bit of economic context for you. Along with retail sales this morning, we got the report on worker productivity for the second quarter, up more than 7% April through June, the best in more than 10 years, which in ordinary times would be great. Increased productivity is a key factor in economic growth. But as I said at the top of the program, these are not normal times. The way productivity is figured, almost literally, is widgets produced per hour worked. In the second quarter, remember the worst so far of this virus, widgets produced, output is the word economists use, collapsed almost 39%. The thing is, hours worked fell 43%. You do the math, widgets produced per hour worked actually went up. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.